Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Preventing Chemotherapy-Induced Nausea and Vomiting, a very important concept of prevention here. And I know many of you are very interested to hear about this program today, and many of you have signed up. This is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and all of your interest in the program today that we have over 536 participants on the call today. And you come from all over the United States, but we also have participants internationally from Canada, Micronesia, Switzerland, and United Kingdom, and Venezuela, so really from all over the world. And it really is a credit to you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's program was supported by Helsinn Therapeutics U.S., and I really want to thank them for their support of this really important program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers, actually, I would say the best of the best, and I'm going to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Richard Grala. Dr. Grala is a professor of medicine, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And Dr. Grala is going to address why some chemotherapy agents cause nausea and vomiting and why communicating with the healthcare team is so important. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Grala.
Hello, and thank you so much, Carolyn. Again, I'm Dr. Richard Grala. I'm a medical oncologist at the Albert Einstein Cancer Center in New York. I have the pleasure of introducing this program, dealing with a very common concern for patients and families getting anti-cancer therapy, and that is how to prevent nausea and vomiting. We have, as Carolyn has mentioned, a wonderful panel assembled today from the U.S. and Canada with leading and accomplished experts. My colleagues are highly regarded worldwide, not only for their knowledge and experience, but also for their skills in delivering excellent care. As Carolyn mentioned, I'm going to review two topics as background for the program. These include, why can chemotherapy cause nausea and vomiting, and give a brief outline of current approaches, and why is communicating with your healthcare team a priority? First, why concentrate on communication? Well, I can think of several reasons, but a couple of major ones are to, first of all, individualize care. And I hope that you will see in my presentation and those of my colleagues why that is a key. The short answer is so that your care can have as positive an effect as possible and will contribute to preserving and improving quality of life. And the second is to maximize benefit. Remarkable changes in cancer care, including new modalities of treatment and new ways to prevent side effects, have occurred over the past very few years. It's fair to say that we're in an evolutionary period of maximizing the benefit of these newer methods. Supportive care, that is, the prevention of side effects, among other definitions, is at least as individualized and complicated as anti-cancer care. A relatively new term that you may hear is precision medicine. While many definitions are possible, one that I think works well comes from the National Institutes of Health. And that states, and I'm quoting, is precision medicine is an emerging approach for disease prevention and treatment that takes into account people's individual variations in genes, environment, and lifestyle. Some issues and problems occur only in some individuals and not in others. Through communication, all can be aware of risks or lack of risks, all of which helps in having the best remedy or prevention applied. Also, in decision-making, informed shared decision-making really occurs through communication. There's another new term called patient-reported outcomes, or PROs. This reflects that in many areas, only through patient and family input can we truly understand the issues that need to be addressed. Of course, in many instances, your doctor or nurse may raise the issue, but there's no need to stand on ceremony. It's fine to bring it up first. In fact, it's appreciated. Physicians and nurses, social workers and pharmacists, among others in oncology, spend a great deal of time educating themselves about the best approaches to various problems, including the prevention of nausea and vomiting. And so do their oncology organizations, such as ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, ONS, the Oncology Nursing Society, MASC, the Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer, Cancer Care, which is bringing us this program today, and others. We should be considered to be your team, and by working together, much will be accomplished. Well, patients and families have told us that control of nausea and vomiting with chemotherapy is at or near the top of their expressed concerns. That's why it really is worth our discussing this important issue, an area in which great progress has been made in recent years, and an area in which continued improvements are occurring. We'll hear Dr. Warr talk about the basic, important approach, and Dr. Schwartzberg will address areas of newer research, and Ms. Clark Snow will talk about the role of working with your nurse. Vomiting or emesis and nausea can be a problem to address and prevent in all aspects of cancer care. That is, with initial diagnosis or treatment postoperatively, with radiotherapy, or with chemotherapy. Now, we're going to focus on nausea and vomiting related to chemotherapy in this program, but when we take questions, all areas are fair for discussion. Again, fortunately, a lot of progress has been achieved, and my colleagues will go into quite a bit of detail. Most people are not aware of the progress that has been made. I wish that that the news media, television and magazines and newspapers would get it right. The news media with television, magazines and newspapers, and especially movies, really don't portray the progress that has been made. It's safe to say that these days the majority of people getting modern anti-cancer treatment will not experience nausea and vomiting from it, although some will. Why can nausea and vomiting occur? It's a normal protective response. Medicines to treat your cancer, chemotherapy, can be considered to be essentially foreign substances, and the body didn't evolve to sense that we would take in substances by intravenous means. So everything is a reaction as though we ate something, though we took it in through the GI tract. Sensors or receptors in the gut and in the brain monitor chemicals in the blood and the cerebrospinal fluid, not just in the stomach. It's a tricky but important protective reflex, but of course we would like to turn it off when it's not needed. Knowing these mechanisms is key. This gives us leads on how to prevent emesis, nausea and vomiting. We can block the important receptors or sensors temporarily, and in that way we can prevent nausea and vomiting. We learned several years ago that certain receptors sense serotonin, a naturally occurring chemical in the body, and these are important in the process, both in the gastrointestinal tract and the brain. Today, we can block those receptors with certain Cetron drugs, which, when used properly, are very helpful and have very few side effects for most people. We then learned that another pathway, which is associated with a small naturally occurring protein transmitter, which is called substance P, is also important, especially in the brain. Medicines to address this pathway, called NK1 pathway or NK1 receptors, are also important, and also, indeed, these medicines have few side effects for most people. And an older class of medicines, those related to cortisone or to corticosteroids, also have an important role for many. We learned that there are two clear needs preventing what is called acute emesis, the nausea and vomiting on the day of treatment, and the second was to get better results in preventing delayed emesis, which can occur in days following chemotherapy, which is why at times your doctors and nurses will ask you to take some medicines even if you're feeling great a few days after chemotherapy. And it turns out that certain risk factors which differ among individuals are valuable to know about, such as the actual chemotherapy a person's to be given, a person's gender, their age group, and several more. Based on these and some other factors, your healthcare team can individualize your preventive medicines for nausea and vomiting. Should a person get just one anti-nausea medicine or two or three? Would prevention include a Cetron, an NK1 agent, or a corticosteroid, or even some other medications? This is the way that the care is individualized. The Cetrons and NK1s are very focused on one pathway each, but recently adding less focused medicines can have potential benefit for some people as well. Newer approaches even include how the antiemetics are given. There are oral medications, including the use of a single pill given just once, that can be useful for many individuals. Or should the medicines be given IV right before chemotherapy and perhaps continued in the days after chemotherapy? How can the antiemetic medicines be given as effectively and conveniently as possible? All these topics, including more on communication and steps that you should be aware of, will be addressed by my colleagues in the next few presentations. Carolyn?
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Grala. That was really outstanding and really, really set the tone for today's program, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Lee Schwartzberg. Dr. Schwartzberg is Executive Director, West Cancer Center, Chief, Division of Hematology Oncology, Professor of Medicine, University of Tennessee Health Science Center. And Dr. Schwartzberg is going to address current research directions to improve control of nausea and vomiting and new agents. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Schwartzberg.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's an absolute pleasure to be on the call with all of you and with my colleagues who are speaking. So my task is to talk about the newer research, and we're very excited about the new research for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. And I want to start by taking you through the timeline of how we have developed the drugs that Dr. Grala talked about in general terms over the last 30 years. And it was understanding the pathway and getting to understand the biology of nausea and vomiting that led us to effective treatments for this condition. In the same way that understanding the biology of any given disease, including the many cancers that we treat, has resulted in more effective treatments. So by understanding, by research, basic research and translational research, which lets us understand how the body handles things, how cancer cells work, if we're talking about those, and then developing treatments that target those pathways is the way we make progress. And the same is true with what's been happening over the last 30 years for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, and specifically I'm going to talk about the last couple of years where there's been an exciting resurgence of new drugs that are being developed to help improve the lot of patients and to achieve ultimately what our final goal is. And our final goal is we would like no patient who receives chemotherapy to have any nausea or vomiting. That's a lofty goal. We're not there yet, but we keep inching closer to that goal. And what I think you'll hear all of us say is that the majority of patients who get treated today should not experience any emesis or any vomiting. And the majority of patients today, regardless of the type of chemotherapy they get, should have good control of nausea, if at all possible. And we have many different ways to achieve that. So we talked about the different classes of drugs that we use, the Cetrons, which target a serotonin antagonist, which is an important component of the initial response to nausea and vomiting to a toxic substance like chemotherapy. The NK1 receptor antagonists, which target that NK1 small molecule and that receptor, and corticosteroids, which are a mainstay of treatment through many different pathways. The drug development over the last few years has focused on new Cetrons and new NK1 antagonists. Up until a few years ago, we had one available agent for the NK1 antagonist, a aprepitant, which was originally developed as an oral drug, but it was a short-acting drug and had to be delivered over several days. That was a little bit problematic because patients, if they got sick on day two or three after chemotherapy, it was difficult for them to take any oral agents in some cases. And it was just the convenience also of having to take a drug for multiple days. In 2008, a aprepitant was reformulated as a intravenous drug called fosaprepitant, and that opened up a new era several years ago for allowing the complete intravenous cocktail, if you will, to be delivered for prevention before chemotherapy. So the general goal is to give the drugs before chemotherapy to prevent nausea and vomiting. So they're already in the system and circulating to block those receptors that Dr. Grala talked about and keep patients from getting sick either acutely or in the delayed phase. Well, we didn't really have any further development until 2014, and I'm pleased to say that starting in 2014, for the last 3 years, we've had three new drugs approved for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. The first of them is called Akynzeo, or NEPA, which stands for the two drugs, nitupatint and palonosetron. Nitupatint is a new NK1 receptor antagonist, and palonosetron is a so-called second-generation Cetron, which was developed after the other several drugs that were first studied and approved in the United States for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. And palonosetron, when given in a doublet therapy with dexamethasone, as it is for several different types of chemotherapies that have a moderate risk of causing emesis, is a very effective drug and is long-acting. NEPA was a combination of palonosetron and nitupatin, as I said, and it was formulated in a single capsule. And this has great convenience because you're taking two drugs as an oral capsule before chemotherapy. NEPA was compared to previous drugs, Cetron and dexamethasone, and found to be highly effective and superior against many different types of chemotherapies. And so it was approved in 2014 as an alternative. And one of the things I want to emphasize that Dr. Grala touched on is we're in an era of precision oncology or personalized medicine that refers not only to understanding the pathways and to the types of treatments that we give, but also can be extended to represent the patient-oriented approaches and the patient-oriented choices. So if we have drugs that work, we want to give patients as many options as possible to get their medications the way they want to. So here is a way where a patient can get an all-oral therapy, which would include the NEPA capsule, as well as the corticosteroid, which can be given orally or intravenously as the preventive regimen. The other benefit of NEPA is that it's very long-acting. So nitupatin and palonosetron, both of them are long-acting agents. They protect a patient through the entire period during which chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting tend to occur, which is generally about 5 days after chemotherapy. At that point, the toxins are out of the system and the receptors have changed. And so generally speaking, if you have nausea and vomiting after 5 days, it's typically not due to the chemotherapy you got sometime before that. In 2015, another new NK1 antagonist was approved. This is a drug called Varubi, the generic name Relopatint. Relopatint is another new NK1 antagonist. It has advantages as well over some of the older drugs. It has less interactions with other agents, and many patients who have cancer are taking other drugs. We've learned over the years that several different drugs can stimulate metabolism of other drugs, and so there happens what are called drug-drug interactions. We try to minimize those as much as possible so that we know that each drug we're giving is getting into the system in the most effective way and the full amount. And so Relopatin has that as an advantage. Relopatin is also an oral pill that is taken before chemotherapy with the other drugs that prevent nausea and vomiting. And it is also a long-acting medication and also protects against the whole period of risk. And so we now have two new NK1 antagonists. In 2016, we just had an approval of a long-acting form of one of the older drugs called granisetron. It's one of the Cetrons that blocks serotonin, and it has been given for many years now, either orally or intravenously, but it's a short-acting medication. It's been reformulated as a drug called APF-530 generically, or Sustol, This was just approved by the FDA very recently in the last few weeks, and this is a time-release injection that, again, protects over the entire 5 days of risk using a formulation, which is a novel formulation, to slowly release the medication and have it work better. So this is yet another option in one of the classes of agents. Finally, we have an old drug that Dr. Gralla referenced, which is a drug that doesn't target one pathway but targets multiple pathways in the brain that contribute to chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. Besides the ones that have been mentioned, other receptors that are important are those that trigger dopamine and some others that are probably less important by themselves but work in a network like so many of the things in our central nervous systems. There's a lot of redundancy as systems have developed. So this drug is called olanzapine. It was used as a psychiatric drug, and it's an old drug that's generic, but it's been known for years that it works for nausea and vomiting, particularly nausea, which is the particular area that we're still having some trouble with. And in a study that was just published just a few weeks ago in our most premier medical journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, a four-drug combination, including olanzapine, Cetron, an NK1, and a corticosteroid, showed superiority in protecting nausea, patients from having any nausea at all after getting a highly nausea and emesis-contributing regimen. So the four-drug regimen was better than the three-drug regimen, with the only additional side effect of some mild to moderate sedation because the pill does cause sleepiness when given for a couple of days in addition. So that's another oral medication that can be added. So if we start to think about where we are today, the large majority of patients will have no nausea and vomiting with the correct and appropriate anti-nausea prevention regimen. So it's a very exciting time. We're going to see other drugs developed against other pathways, and our goal of no nausea and vomiting is coming closer to reality each year. Carolyn, I'll turn it over back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Schwartzberg. That was really excellent and so much detail and lots of information, and people can really get a better grasp of all the different agents that are out there and also the combinations of the agents, how important that is. I'm sure there'll be questions during the Q&A about this as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. David Warr. Dr. Warr is Head Breast Medical Oncology, Princess Margaret Cancer Center, Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, University of Toronto, Canada. And Dr. Warr is going to address how healthcare teams approach prevention of nausea and vomiting and prevention strategies. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Warr.
Good afternoon, and I'm delighted to join this conversation. You've heard about how things should go very well. Well, there are times when they don't, and that relates to the issue of healthcare teams and how well they function. And by the healthcare team, I'm principally referring to, in terms of the professionals, the medical oncologist, the nurse, and a pharmacist. And these can be strong teams, and there can be weak links, and not infrequently that weak link is a physician. And their roles can vary. For example, an advanced practice nurse and some pharmacists can actually order the antiemetics. My daughter, for example, does so in Calgary, in Canada. On the surface, the approach should be simple. Prescribe medications recommended by evidence-based guidelines. There are a couple, MASC, ESMO, or NCCN, and there are others. And they're readily available online, but they're actually read by relatively few healthcare professionals. Now, just to explain how these work, since chemotherapy regimens vary enormously in their tendency to cause nausea and vomiting, and we don't want to be wasteful in terms of money or have excessive side effects from the antiemetics themselves, the guidelines actually tailor the antiemetics to the emetogenicity of the chemotherapy. So there are four categories, and with each category, there's a corresponding antiemetic. So, for example, with a minimal category where you don't normally have any nausea or vomiting, such as some of the antibody therapies, or vincristine or vinorelbine, nothing is recommended. For the highest emetogenicity, such as the cisplatin regimens or some common adjuvant chemotherapy regimens in breast cancer patients, there's a combination of at least three drugs, and you heard Dr. Schwartzberg refer to those three or with olanzapine four drugs that are used. So one can easily construct antiemetics to match the chemotherapy. Now, the way that sounds simple enough, but things get a little more complicated than that, and that in part relates to the order entry systems that your doctors use, whether it's paper or electronic. So this can be suboptimal. In some systems, the choice by the physician is entirely discretionary. So a doctor who's ill-informed might decide to prescribe only one drug when clinical trials have demonstrated that at least a combination of three are necessary. Or the system may be based on what was appropriate 15 years ago before we had the newer drugs described by Dr. Schwartzberg. And in that sort of system, to order the best regimen may take an extra few minutes. So sadly, some doctors in a busy clinic simply decide that the pre-specified regimen, which is suboptimal, surely must be good enough. Second, there's need for appropriate education and of course, follow-up, as you heard, and you will hear, I expect, from Becky, because the results of the recommended approaches are pretty good, but they're not perfect, and patients, once in a while, don't follow the instructions on the bottle. And third, there are sometimes financial issues. This newest drug category, the NK1 receptor antagonists, they're expensive, and that may influence choices, unfortunately, sometimes without the patient taking part in that decision. Sometimes doctors just assume in some countries that the patient cannot afford it when they would be willing to pay for it. A well-functioning team communicates so that they're on the same page and they know who's doing what. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You heard Dr. Schwartzberg refer to olanzapine, which is an increasingly popular antiemetic, still under-recognized, that happens to have come on to the market as an antipsychotic. And if a patient wanted to learn more about the drug and went to Dr. Google, and if no education was provided by the team or not appropriate education, the patient might think it's the healthcare team that's crazy and decide not to take it. You also heard about sedation with olanzapine. Well, one of the things that we don't want is for a patient to take the tablet before their chemotherapy and then drive or perhaps even take public transportation while they're sedated, because that's a safety issue. So you need appropriate education. And you need a certain skill set in the team as well. And as an example, we have nurses who will triage between visits. And if nausea or vomiting starts a week or more after chemotherapy, our nurses understand that they need to be looking at something else other than the chemotherapy as the cause, because it shouldn't start that late. And they need to start thinking about, are they taking a pain medication? Are they a patient who has disease in their belly and they have a blocked bowel? Or whether they have severe heartburn that's then triggering a nausea reflex. So the good news is that with a good team and a good system for ordering the recommended drugs, these days very few patients will vomit. And the nausea that occurs is much better controlled than when Dr. Grau and I started out too many years ago. And now back to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ward. That was really outstanding, and really the whole concept of making these decisions and how physicians make these decisions is really important, how they work together. So thank you for this very important perspective. And I know the question's for you as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Rebecca Clark-Snow. Ms. Snow is an oncology nurse, and she'll be addressing the role of the oncology nurse in preventing side effects and the importance of clinical trials. And Ms. Rebecca Clark-Snow is an oncology clinical nurse coordinator at the University of Kansas Cancer Center. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Clark-Snow.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, everyone. Oncology nurses can make a significant impact on patient outcomes in our daily practice and usually are the first line of communication between physicians and our patients. Being part of an institutional multidisciplinary team is important, as Dr. Ward just mentioned, and I'm just going to include some additional important members of that team. In addition to physicians and nurses and social workers, we have dietitians and psychologists who all work together for a common goal, and that is to make sure that our patients' experience during this journey is one that is a positive experience and one where they're comfortable and family members have all the information that they need. So once again, being part of this team, we promote and reinforce guideline-recommended antiemetic prophylaxis and improve healthcare providers' adherence to evidence-based guideline recommendations. At least that's our goal. In doing so, nurses need to be aware of either national, international, or institutional antiemetic guidelines that are available. Probably our most important contribution is providing education and communicating with patients and family members regarding their treatment, their anti-cancer treatment plan that will include a comprehensive supportive care plan. And generally this takes place before treatment and even continues during treatment and by nurses in clinic and in the treatment area as well. Assuring that there is an understanding of which antiemetics have been prescribed and the importance of taking them as directed, as mentioned by Dr. Gralla, even if patients are not experiencing any problems with emesis. Giving patients available tools to monitor and record responses to treatment. These tools can include daily diaries using the MASC anti-emesis tool. That's the Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer anti-emesis tool, which is available as a free download on the MASC website. This provides patients with an opportunity to not only see what their regimens are for the next several days, but also to document their responses and share that information with their healthcare providers. Most importantly, I think providing follow-up by phone or perhaps even using your institution's electronic medical record program, such as MyChart, which is a messaging system that patients can interact with their nurses and send non-urgent messages, which can be really answered in real time. I think this is just another tool that's available for us to communicate with our patients and get that information back to physicians if necessary. I also want to just spend a little time and tell you about a poster presentation that was presented at this year's Oncology Nursing Society meeting in San Antonio. This particular poster reviewed the results of a survey of more than 500 oncology nursing members. The purpose was to assess awareness of guidelines and obtain information on current practice patterns and administration of antiemetics, something that nurses do on a daily basis. It was a 21-question email survey in which almost all nurses were somewhat confident in their knowledge of the emetogenic potential or the ability of some drugs to cause nausea and vomiting, having a knowledge of chemotherapy agents and the regimens. Nurses in the outpatient setting had a greater confidence compared to those nurses in the inpatient setting, and this isn't surprising since most patients receive their treatment on an outpatient basis. Nurses were most familiar with and used the National Comprehensive Cancer Center Network guidelines compared to other guidelines available. In the survey, nurses reported that physician preference was the greatest barrier, possibly interfering with the use of guideline-recommended antiemetic prophylaxis, which Dr. Warr alluded to a little bit. And I think this is a finding that will be beneficial and be followed up on in a previous, in a future survey. Not surprising, nurses reported that controlling delayed chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting was the greatest practice challenge. So while our physicians have mentioned that most patients do very well, we do have a problem with patients having some issues with a delayed nausea and vomiting, and it's usually nausea that is causing our patients discomfort. So this survey highlighted opportunities to increase nurses' awareness of antiemetic guidelines, to develop practical, multifaceted approaches for overcoming barriers interfering with antiemetic use within their practice, and to ultimately improve chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting control, as well as quality of life for our patients receiving anti-cancer treatment. I've also been asked to briefly touch on the importance of clinical trials. The majority of my career as an oncology nurse has been in the role of a research coordinator, assisting with even the very early trials with ondansetron, or Zofran, which is our first serotonin antagonist to provide significant improvement in the prophylaxis and treatment of chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. Doctors Grala, Schwartzberg, and Warr have all been instrumental in conducting supportive care research that has resulted in the approval and use of the most effective antiemetics to date. Of course, none of this would have been possible without the participation of thousands of patients and the support of their family members, who not only participate in supportive care trials, but in important treatment trials as well. We've come a long way these past 35 years, and my hope, and which is also the hope of our panel members, is that in the not-too-distant future, we will one day have the ability to prevent not for all patients treated with medicines that offer cures over, cures and palliation. Thank you. Back to you, Carolyn.
Thank you so much, Ms. Clark Snow. That was really outstanding and really so much information for people, and also the resource of the app that people can access from the MASS website, which we'll send out to people as well. And also just the importance of clinical trials to highlight that. That's really outstanding. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlund. And Ms. Edlund is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. She is an online support group program director at Cancer Care, and she will be addressing the free psychosocial services and programs at Cancer Care offers and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Edlund.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. And I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and experiencing treatment side effects such as chemo-induced nausea and vomiting. Cancer Care can be part of your support network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your family. A cancer care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer care services are there to help you. So please do contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Edlin. That was really excellent. And now I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to take as many questions as we can. And I'm going to ask Candace to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. And again, we'll take as many of your questions as we can. And if I don't get to your questions, if we don't get to them, then I will give you a resource of how to get your questions answered. So, but let's see how many we can take right now. So, Candace, if you could let everybody know how to queue up for questions, and we should bring all of our speakers on board as well.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1.
We have a question from our online participants from Bruce. If drugs have to be changed in midstream due to any reason, is there a waiting period or does it matter? So I'm going to ask almost all of you to weigh in on it, but I'm going to ask Dr. Grala to start, then Dr. Schwartzberg, Dr. War, and Ms. Clark Snow.
Could you repeat the question, please?
So the question is, if drugs have to be changed midstream due to any reason, is there a waiting period or does it matter? From our online participants, I'm assuming it means the drugs that we're using for nausea and vomiting.
Well, so this is Richard Grala. It's a good question. If the antiemetics that you're taking are not working well enough for you, then it is important to discuss that with your healthcare team, and they will guide you on which drugs could be repeated, should be repeated or replaced, or if in fact it's not even a drug issue. Dr. Schwartzberg mentioned the fact that the timing of when nausea and vomiting occurs is really very important. So if it's not in a time period when we'd expect this to be due to the chemotherapy, then no, none of these drugs would be appropriate. Fortunately, most of these drugs are quite safe, but they need to be used just right, and that's another reason why communication with your healthcare team is vital, and be able to communicate with them, and they'll let you know right away. Lee, do you want to address that as well?
Sure. So there is no waiting time for the most part for these drugs, except for the longer-acting drugs. We usually don't add on another drug of the same class if they're still in the system, because we assume that they're still in there working. But we do have other classes of drugs that we haven't discussed on today's call that are particularly useful for patients who develop what we call refractory or breakthrough nausea. So despite our best efforts, there's still a minority of patients that do have symptoms. And in those cases, we frequently can add an additional drug. And I want to emphasize what Dr. Grala said, which is the communication between the healthcare team and the patient is critical there to understand the types of symptoms, what might be causing them or what might not, and how best to avoid them in subsequent cycles of chemotherapy.
Rebecca, how would you advise patients to know exactly the best way to communicate with their team?
So I think the that the best thing to do is for you know, there to be this two-way open line of communication between nurses and patients, and patients knowing that they can contact their nurses with any concerns that they have if they feel like their medicines are not working, so that nurses can follow up and really sort of get more information, find out exactly what point during their treatment, you know, perhaps the medication has failed to provide significant coverage, so that that information can then be discussed with the physician. So just being able to communicate easily with patients or family members if the patients are feeling too ill to even give us that information.
And David, you mentioned the importance of healthcare teams and even your daughter as a pharmacist being involved. Do you think that most major centers in Canada are tuned into this same issue of having the proper support team for patients?
I think it's quite variable. I had my daughter told me about a physician who was ordering a highly emetogenic regimen and was going to order only a Prepotent without any other antiemetics, and she suggested they might do otherwise. So there's a lot of heterogeneity, and I just wanted to comment related to the question that was asked. Once in a while, there are systems issues. For example, if you have to get a drug at a particular pharmacy, there can be sometimes delays in getting in a drug that they don't commonly stock. So in Canadian pharmacies, they wouldn't commonly stock a Prepotent, so one shouldn't expect to be able to go into a general pharmacy and get the same-day prescription, and once in a while there are insurance approval issues in some countries. So once in a while there are some delays, but they're not common because these drugs are generally fairly widely available.
I think those are great points, and there is in the U.S. pre-approval, so making sure that you're working carefully with your healthcare team can smooth many of those issues.
Excellent point, and of course the healthcare team is really quite a large team, and you want to be sure to access all those members and really get all the help that you can get. That's really important. We have a question from one of our other online participants. So I remember my grandfather suffering from severe chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, which makes me anxious about my impending treatment. How have nausea and vomiting treatments progressed in recent years, and do symptoms vary more person to person or cancer to cancer? So I think we've addressed part of the first part of that question, but the second part in terms of do symptoms vary person to person or cancer to cancer. So I'm wondering if Dr. Schwartzberg, if you could address that question.
Sure. So they don't so much change by the cancer for the most part, so we don't consider that a particularly important risk factor. But they do change by the person, and they do change most importantly by the type of chemotherapy. So Dr. Warren mentioned that we've now categorized every single chemotherapy agent into a risk of developing emesis. And so we categorize them as highly emetogenic, which means virtually all the time if you get this without prevention, which doesn't happen, but in the days before that you would get nausea and vomiting, then moderate, which is a broad range of about 30 to 90% risk, and then low, which is 10 to 30%, and then virtually none, which is minimal. A lot of the newer agents, as mentioned, including some of the biologicals that we're seeing, tend to be in that lower group. But some of the newer agents and many of the common chemotherapy drugs that we use, like cisplatinum and the combination of adriamycin and cyclophosphamide, commonly used in breast cancer, are in that high end, highly emetogenic. So we first look at the drugs. And the drugs give us the biggest criteria for what the risk of nausea and vomiting is. Secondly, and increasingly, we're starting to look at patient risk factors. The two most important patient risk factors are we know that women, for some reason, are more likely to develop nausea and vomiting than men, given the exact same chemotherapy regimen for the same disease. So that's one characteristic. We also know younger people are more likely to develop nausea and vomiting than older. So the healthcare provider and the team, as we've been emphasizing, should take these things into account, particularly when the particular regimen, the types of drugs that are given, fall into that moderate range where it could be relatively low or relatively high and could be influenced by patient risk factors.
Let me just approach one thing. So we don't know when your grandfather was treated. It could have been last month or it could have been 20 years ago. But most of the drugs that were discussed on this call are products of the 2000s, not before that. And some of the drugs that Dr. Schwartzberg mentioned have only become available in the last year or two or even less. So not only have treatments changed a lot for different cancers, so have the anti-nausea medicines. So this would be something where I would say, since this is a concern for you, by all means, you should address this with your doctors and nurses, and they will describe to you exactly how they plan to prevent your nausea and vomiting.
That's such an excellent point. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants. And actually from one of our telephone participants.
And our phone question comes from the line of Sudwati C. Your line is now open.
Hi there. I was wondering if there's any kind of food or meals you would suggest before chemotherapy treatment to help kind of alleviate any of the potential side effects. I mean, I've heard of anecdotal stories, but I was just wondering if there was anything that you all as professionals in the field could recommend.
Well, thank you for that question. That's an excellent question. I know people often wonder about that. Ms. Clark-Snow, could you address that question?
Well, I think that is a very good question. And I think in the past what's been recommended is that patients sort of try to consume bland meals, non-spicy food. But I think what we tell patients is to eat a well-balanced diet, and to eat things that you'd like to eat, and if you run into difficulty during treatment and actually do develop nausea and vomiting, then you sort of want to take it easy and eat things that are not likely to upset your stomach any more than it already is upset. But I don't think there are clear guidelines as far as recommending food before treatment. It's really sort of afterwards and seeing how you do with tolerating your treatment while letting the anti-nausea medicines work.
Unfortunately, over many years, people have been unable to come up with specific diets that will prevent nausea and vomiting.
Mm-hmm.
As such, as Becky's saying. And the advice has been more eat in moderation and not too fatty foods and things mm-hmm. like this. But I agree with you entirely that foods that you find pleasant and very tolerable are the best. I wish that there was some sort of magic diet that would prevent nausea and vomiting, but so far that's not been found.
You know, the other important thing to consider is, of course, you know, many of our patients while undergoing treatment have very significant taste changes. Food just doesn't taste the same, and there is that feeling that you do not want to eat. And we have patients visit with the dietitian at the beginning of treatment and during that treatment period also to offer some useful suggestions.
Excellent point. The dietitians can be very helpful. Also, what about the issue of hydration and fluids? Is that something that people need to consider before they have chemotherapy, or is that something to consider, or Dr. Grala?
Well, yes, I think it is good to maintain good and adequate hydration. For certain chemotherapy medicines, it's important to really be hydrated, such as cisplatin and the platinum drugs in general, but it's never a good idea to be underhydrated. So drinking fluids that you enjoy, fluids of value, can be very important. And, you know you're drinking enough when you're urinating a little bit more than you'd like to. So it is indeed, as Carolyn mentions, a good idea to make sure that you're maintaining good hydration.
Well, thank you. We have one late-breaking question from Mary, an online participant. Is anticipatory nausea vomiting treated the same as regular nausea vomiting? I have seen that medications sometimes are less effective, and then we use other treatments like stress reductions. Dr. Ward, do you want to address that?
Sure. And the first message that Dr. Growler and Dr. Schwartzberg and Becky would say is you try to prevent ever getting to the point where it's anticipatory, and it is extremely uncommon to have anticipatory vomiting these days if you use the right antiemetics. Some anticipatory nausea occurs. The most common approach has been using something that is relatively sedating, like lorazepam. There certainly have been a couple of publications showing success with psychological approaches, desensitization therapy, and although it has been taught to doctors and nurses in the context of one study, it's never really been picked up because I think of the time involved both by the patient and the therapist. But yes, it can work, and years ago I did have a psychologist working with one patient before we had all these wonderful drugs. But in general, the idea is prevent it, and if necessary, give something to relax, because this is often associated with anxiety and poor sleep the night before.
Well, thank you. This has been an extraordinary call. I have to say we could be going on quite a bit longer. There are many more questions, but we're going to have to, we said this would be an hour program, so I want to thank our speakers. You've really been outstanding, extraordinary team. I also want to thank all of you who've queued up for questions, both on the telephone and online, and all of you who've been listening as well. Now, before we conclude the call, I want to say a few things, and one is that if you still have some medical questions that you wish to have asked, wish to have answered, actually, and would like information about, I certainly recommend that you talk to your healthcare team, of course, and that everybody on the call today take back the information you learned and share it with your healthcare team if you have further questions. So in addition to that, we often recommend that people also call the National Cancer Institute. Their information specialists are really standing by after our programs to answer any questions that you may have. And their number is 1-800-422-6237, 1-800-422-6237, or you can visit their website at www.cancer.gov, and they have a helpline that will help you right away. It's a kind of an online chat that you can ask your question online as well. Now, in addition, if you also have just some concerns about accessing services from cancer care, whether it be talking to our oncology social workers or getting some financial assistance with the cost of your care or joining one of our telephone support groups or online support groups. I very much recommend that you just go ahead and call Cancer Care directly at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673. And our oncology social workers are here to help you. We also have a website, www.cancercare.org, where you can also access help from us as well. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, we don't want any one of you on the call today to feel that you are alone in coping. We want you to now know that you're part of this cancer care community and that we're here to help you. And that to please do take advantage of all the services we offer. And also think about the information you gathered today. This program will be on telephone replay as well as be available as a podcast just within a day, so you'll be able to listen to it again if you wanted to hear some of the things that were said again. It's always nice to listen to the programs again because you sometimes hear things the second time that you might have missed the first time. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.